Good morning, everyone. We're getting ready to start, so I'm going to ask everybody to take their seats, please, so that we can start on time. Thank you for joining us for this briefing, which will examine the issue of how to advance social integration and intergenerational solidarity in observance of the International Day of Families. As usual, before we begin our briefing, may I remind those of you with cell phones to ensure that they are turned off or put on silent. We ask you to do this as a courtesy to our speakers, so please take the time to do so now. We'd also like to reiterate that flash photography, audio, or video recording of our events is only permitted with prior authorization from the NGO Relations section. We encourage live tweeting, however, during our briefings using our Twitter hashtag, which is hashtag DPINGO. And it's very easy, just hashtag DPINGO. So if you would like to tweet to the rest of the world, please do so. We'd like to thank our speakers for taking the time to be with us, and we take this opportunity also to acknowledge our partner in the Division for Social Policy and Development of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. Renata, since you're standing, please remain standing, Ms. Renata Kaczmaska, who has worked with us on putting together today's event, as she's the focal point on family in DESA. And she's been instrumental in putting today's briefing together, and we thank her sincerely. Advancing social integration and intergenerational solidarity have been important objectives of social development, but they're now even more necessary given the demographic challenges the international community is currently facing. In today's global society, we are seeing dramatically changing demographic trends, in some cases on an unprecedented scale. For instance, our current global generation of youth is the largest the world has ever known. At the same time, populations in many countries are rapidly aging, which is cause for celebration, but also cause for concern for our current pension and healthcare systems. There is no doubt that these challenges put into sharp focus a growing interdependence between generations. The primary goal of social integration is to create a society for all in which all members of society are equally included in its social, political, and economic structures. Intergenerational solidarity is closely linked to the concept of social integration as it involves promoting regular interaction among people of all ages and generations to ensure care and support, whether material or non-material. Research in OECD countries demonstrates that advancing social integration and intergenerational solidarity helps to reduce poverty and inequalities, and in this context, are important in assisting the global community to achieve many of the Millennium Development Goals. The NGO community has a critical role to play in this process, especially through its engagement with governments, educational institutions, and organizations that see to the care of our seniors around the world. It is also important to note the significance of the twin themes of social integration and intergenerational solidarity as the main focus of this year's observance of the International Day of Families, precisely 1 year ahead of the 20th anniversary of the International Year of the Family. These twin themes will be given special attention by the world community this year as part of the preparations for that 20th anniversary. The other main subjects of discussion, which will also receive special focus during the 2011 and 2012 International Day of Families, include family poverty and work-life balance. As we anticipate next year's milestone anniversary, we take the opportunity of this year's observance of the International Day of Families to discuss the kind of measures NGOs and civil society can take to promote social integration and intergenerational solidarity. We've put together a panel of experts to help us examine the issue, and you will hear from them in a few minutes. First, before we discuss today's topic of advancing social integration and intergenerational solidarity, we'd like to screen a video for you, which gives you a very practical example of what intergenerational solidarity actually looks like. Can we dim the lights, please?
There are a number of advantages to living in a multi-generational community. One thing that we find if you look at a senior-only development, oftentimes the conversation stays on three P's: pains, pills, and passing. What you'll see is a community where young people walk down one side of the street, older people walk down the other side of the street. They never have a chance to meet in the middle and say hello. Many towns and cities are realizing they don't have to build a senior center and a teen center and a community center. They can build a multi-generational center that serves all. Multi-generational or intergenerational communities are ones that have facilities and amenities, programs, outdoor space that are accessible to all ages as well as appealing to all ages.
We have a great influx of retiring boomers. They're young, they're active, and they do not want to be segregated from their communities. They want to be engaged.
We need a focal point for the community. We can put together a senior center, we can put together a community center, but if we work together, we can put together something very special.
We needed some recreational opportunities out here for both young people and for seniors, and had a growing population of both young and old, so we decided to put the facility together, and it's really worked out well for us.
We have young people up there, we have senior citizens using it. Anytime you can get them to interact on a social basis, even at this center, exercising or whatever, it's a tremendous opportunity.
It's a great use of the city's resources. You build a facility that's used around the clock. It's used in the morning by a population. It's used by older adults in the middle of the day, used by teenagers after school, used by families at night. Once you build a community, the real key is how do you get people to be engaged in it? And it's important that there are opportunities, that you have programs that appeal to people of all ages.
We've taken a few different classes. We've taken a painting class, and then in a few weeks we have a yoga class that we're taking.
We've got gymnastics, they've got cooking classes, we've got She's in a Jumping Beans class.
We have exercising upstairs where they babysit the children while the parents are exercising.
My mom was visiting. I could bring her for a whole day of activities here.
It's a great place to come. Keep you young anyway. It's better than staying home.
Enjoying themselves and talking to other folks, and you have the interaction of the young people and the seniors. So high energy is how I describe it.
I know she can't wait until she's old enough to do the climbing wall. It's something that she focuses on every time she comes through here.
When they watch them climb the rock wall, it gives them, I remember when I used to do that. Seeing them play basketball, even if they just are watching them, it really gives them a boost, and they remember when their kids were little, and it helps bring back the memories for them.
So it could be teenagers who are helping older adults learn how to use the computers. It could be older adults that are teaching etiquette and how you play pool to teenagers who are just learning how to pick up a cue stick.
Where would you want to hit the white ball? Like, what part of it?
So it all depends on what I want the ball to do. We've got some young fellows here that can play with the best of them. And they whomp up on me every once in a while.
I love the fact that when we walk through, the other people that are here talk to the kids.
Like for my son, for example, he misses seeing grandma, so when he sees all the other grandparents here too, it's just part of what we're used to having in the family.
For older people, they realize that there's a hope for the future. They're able to pass on their wisdom, feel like they're leaving something behind, that they're investing in the future. Young people learn the wisdom, they learn some of the decision making, they learn some of the skills, the traditions, the connection with roots that people oftentimes lose when they're not with other generations.
Well, you know, the seniors interact with you. It's cool to listen and talk and see what they have to say about it.
Some of the studies have shown that older adults who engage with children rely on canes less often. They take better care of themselves.
The seniors change a lot. Because when I see the kids, they're much calmer. They forget the aches and the pains. It's all love and affection for the kids.
We dance with them, their eyes open, because they know they're going to have an enjoyment with us. It's environment, it's healthy, and it's good for us, and it's good for the children, too.
The city put together the facility and the cost for this facility. We went out into the community and raised the dollars, both public and private, to make the programs possible.
This partnership between the City Parks Program and the Senior Center has really paid us dividends in terms of unique services, cost effectiveness, and more importantly, a great service to the community.
Builders or planners who are looking at creating intergenerational communities or intergenerational centers need to realize that they've got to intentionally plan to engage generations. It's one thing to build something, it's another for people to actually live there and feel that they live there. Generations United can help with that. We can help with the planning, we can help with how you staff it, we can help with how you market it so it appeals to people of all generations.
So often we hear, well, our focus is aging, or our focus is youth development. Well, when you stop and think about how we live our lives, it doesn't really begin and end at one point in time. Healthy communities are communities that are good to grow up in and grow old in.
Thank you very much. I like that last comment. Healthy communities are communities that are going to grow up and are going to grow old. I hope that while you're listening to the other statements, you'll think of what you've just seen, because we let you see this first to prepare the groundwork for our speakers. It is now my privilege to welcome our speakers for today. Our first speaker is His Excellency Mr. Carlos Enrique Garcia Gonzalez, the Ambassador of El Salvador to the United Nations. Excellency, it is a tremendous pleasure to have you here with us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and I would like to start by congratulating you and myself and everybody in this room, because we are commemorating the International Day of Families. And as far as I know, we are part not just of individual families by our own, but also part of humanity, which is our own common family to everyone here, not in this room, but in the whole UN house. And also, of course, to extend my appreciation to the DPI NGO for inviting me, as well as NGO community in general, for giving me this opportunity to share with you some of the ideas that El Salvador is trying to promote as well, not only within our own country, but also in Central America and other Latin American countries, and also a small contribution to what we're trying to do here at the UN. I would like to start sharing with you what, in our view, it's something that very in line in connection with the video that we just had saw. And even though I have, you know, a guide to follow, I just like to say a very quick reaction to that video. In my view, that's precisely what we are trying to get, not only for small communities, but for the whole planet at all. Because this is the issue that I think we are missing right now in this current international situation, where we are, who we are. And we are a member of a family. And we have a tendency in the last years to focus our attention or highlight some, let's say, some part of the whole issue of life. And in doing so, probably some may argue that it's for very good reasons, because there was a lack of rights or policies that helped vulnerable groups in a separate manner to go in that direction. But I guess this time has come for getting united again, because otherwise we are going in a direction that will leave us in a planet where only some selected group of people, either by their age, color, skin, social condition, or any other excuse that we can think of, will prevail. And I don't think that will be the plan for all of us here. And as part of a larger international community, in particular within the United Nations, that is the house where we, the people, I think this is the place where we need to start to promote these ideas. Well, I beg your indulgence to allow me to bore you reading just one paragraph, I promise you. But I have to do it because it's in my screen. And it's about figures, because in order to argue something, I think figures are relevant, but are not the most important one. But I need to do it, so anyway. It says, as established in the latest report on older persons by the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights, presented under document E/2012/51, aging constitutes one of the most significant demographic transformations of the 21st century. Globally, 700 million people, or 10% of the world population, are age 60 or older. Whereas by 2050, this percentage will double, reaching 20%. Contrary to the popular perceptions, all regions will be affected, and in the particular case of Latin America and the Caribbean, this proportion will be higher than expected average, since by 2050, or 25%, or around 188 million people are expected to be aged 60 or older. Full stop. Let the figure out of our sight for a while. This is a very scary figure. I don't know you, but in my case, when I read this kind of information, it just reminds me about what we're doing in El Salvador and Latin America and the globe, in our planet, in different parts of our beautiful Earth or Mother Earth. And the reason for that is because, in a way, we all have contributed to create a kind of society where, for different reasons, competition still be part of the core of our development. And if we look at this figure, we will realize that, you know, for natural reasons, probably people getting to this age in many countries of the planet will not be longer able to contribute to this economic boom or the economic development in our planet. So therefore, in accordance to the logic of our development system, then there's no need to keep them on track. And this is a very serious statement. So the point then would be for countries like, in my case, El Salvador, where we are considering, please, the next slide, we're considering that El Salvador will rise from 9.7% in 2012 to 21.2% in 2050. This not only represents a challenge in terms of demographic population, but also represent an enormous challenge not only for politicians, but for society at all. And this is where my concerns lie, because I see that for different reasons we are not paying attention to these issues. And we used to go in the direction of oldest or old-fashioned measures, meaning charity, meaning creating houses for older people or retired people, you know, giving some old responses to a very fundamental issue of our century, because it's not a matter of how to take care of older population, but it's a matter, as Gail exactly pointed out, in the idea of creating a society for all. But in this, if we're going to take this idea of creating a society for all, it will have to be a society that provide not only, let's say, the economic means or the welfare means, but also an opportunity to live the life with dignity, which is something that makes the difference in this kind of approach. Please, the next slide. So in that regard, if we going to put in the context of what the United Nations is currently doing but also has done in the past, we can go through the some important age or years when, for example, 1982, we have the first World Assembly on Aging, and so on and so forth. 2002, the Second World Assembly on Aging and Plan, International Plan of Action for Madrid, which, by the way, this is a very interesting. I would like to stop just 1 second to say the following. You have been here for many years at the UN, and you know that when we have this international conference, we try to adopt outcome documents, this one in particular, the Madrid International Plan of Action, that reflects the intention of our government to, you know, craft a kind of public policies towards the achievement of these ideas that we have in our plans. For different reasons, sometimes for resources, other times for lack of leadership at the top levels, we not necessarily achieve these goals in at least equal manner or have at least a minimum standard on achievement of these goals. And then we as government try to explain the international community why we are doing so good effort in some areas but not in the others. And in doing so, we again miss the point. The point is not just say, listen, we are good as governments or we are bad as government. It's not the question. It's how we all together, government, civil society, international organizations, are really actively contributing to making sure that all the commitment that we made in that conference, on that kind of conference, you know, are live document or real document with some meaning for the people. Because otherwise, it's just reading some stories or in magazines that do not affect the current life of people. Why I'm saying this? Because all you know that we are trying to go a little bit further in this effort at the international level in trying to start a process of negotiation of an international convention or a legal document that be bounded for every member state in order to address issues relating to elderly. What's the difference with the International Plan of Action for Madrid? The difference is in the first document is a set of commitments that are going to be probably achieved with a voluntary on a voluntary basis if resources are available. That, of course, is an issue that never happened in those days, in particular if we consider the international financial crisis started in 2008. And since that time until now, everything that we are trying to create at the UN is simply blockade because there's no money. But that's a strange statement as well, that there's no money, you know, because money can be found for different resources. I mean, if we consider the issue of international security, maybe we can find a lot of weapons across the planet that are costing millions or, you know, more than millions just to get one simple missile. And there's a lot right now in the planet. So I guess that the question probably is not that we do not have money, but where is the money? Or what the money is doing for or is used for. Anyway, I don't want to be a very controversial person. It's not my role. But my role is just to start to think from a global perspective and share with all of you why it's important for all of us act together. Because if we are really wanted to have this society for all, is a task and should be a priority for everyone. I know probably small countries do not necessarily have the power to, by itself, going in this direction. But if we act together as a human being, probably we can do a move. Well, this is part of what the UN is doing. If you go to the year 2010, there has been established this working group of the General Assembly on aging. In 2011, it's proclaimed June 15 as World Day Awareness of Elder Abuse. In the early, in July 2012, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights published a study on gaps and challenges in the rights of the elderly. So, I'm sorry, the next slide. So if this is the case, then I guess that I would like to share with you what we are trying to do. Probably it's not enough. And hopefully, I think, and I'm positive, it's not enough. And why? Because it gives us an opportunity to share with all of you and act together. It's open windows for cooperation, for alliance, for partnership, for start thinking together as a humanity on what we can do best. In the context of my country, maybe you will know that in the context of the Organization of American States, we are also working on an idea of having an Inter-American Convention on the Rights of Elderly. That process is working well. We have advanced a text on the convention, still on negotiations, but I will say fairly is a very good progress in that regard. Then we start to think that, of course, having a convention in the American state, it's important, but it's not enough. We need to reach all the people because this idea, it's important, and not only for the Americas, but also for the rest of the countries. So in that regard, we start to participate in New York very actively in the working group of aging, and then promoting within this working group on the idea of how we can move towards the adoption or at least start a process of negotiation on a text for an international convention on the elderly and the right of the elder person. Before I move to the next slide, just like to tell you in 2 seconds why I put this lovely lady with the flag of El Salvador. For all of you that do not know her, she is currently our Minister of Health in El Salvador. She is 94 years old, and she is more active than myself. So for me, it's a kind of paying a tribute to a person not only committed to what she is believing and thinking, but she is really doing a great job. And that's why I put her, because you need to have some models to inspire you, and my Minister of Health is inspiring me. Please go to the next slide. So what we are trying to do in the El Salvador proposal on the elderly convention or possible convention, first, we are saying that it's important to recognize or the recognition of the specific needs of the elderly. We have seen in the video different activities that are crucial. And the first one, I will tell my own opinion on that video, is that, okay, it's important to have these facilities, is provide a good space for doing things. But if you notice something, it was not necessarily the facilities in itself, but it's the relationship established between elderly or older person with younger and different age. That's the value of the idea. And that's why we need to understand that there are, you know, different needs for any stage of our life. But we need to also integrate it in kind of different communities or facilities or programs. This is a wonderful example, but perhaps there will be others, because we as a diverse community, a diverse human beings, can find and experience and promote with creativity new ways to doing so. A second element that is fundamental in our proposal is the recognition of the feminization of old age. I have to say that in El Salvador, 54% of our total population are women. We are 6 million people living in El Salvador, and 2.7 million living abroad as a migrant. And from this 0.27 million people, 96% lives here in the United States. So for us, if we are going to be serious in addressing or trying to create a democratic society, it has to go through the empowerment of women. There's no other way around. As simple as numbers and figures are clearing and telling us the way what we have to follow. Then it's important to understand that we are not looking for just a simple, let's say simple, because this word has been demonized or in the last years on the human rights issues. It's not only a human rights treaty. It can be. I mean, it's a combination of human rights with development, because human rights as a simple principle is no longer valid for the, you know, wording of many people across the planet. It has no meaning anymore. And it's a reality. So if that's the case, we need to provide this word the value, but not because on wording, but because we are making sure that other policies or public policies that are connected to the idea of strengthening the human right and dignity of individual is also in line with the vision of members of different governments to promote development. I mean, and this issue of development is also interesting, because we tend to believe that, oh, okay, there are two kinds of countries in the planet, the developed and developing countries. So it's a matter of developing countries. And what they only want is money. Okay, finish. So if that were so narrow vision of the evolution of humanity, we should close this house. We don't need it anymore. The problem is that in these developed countries, still a lot of poverty, still a lot of people is hunger and who doesn't have shelters, who doesn't have houses, you know, many things. You just, you know, go outside of New York. And I'm not blaming the United States or anyone. I'm just saying, listen, development is a matter that is fundamental to everyone. It's not just two kind of countries and or two kind of set of countries anymore. Otherwise, you know, poverty will be eliminated and we will be living in a wonderful world. But I don't think that's the case for now. Now, there's another element which we consider is fundamental. We need to overcome in the welfare vision that was mentioned to you before towards a paradigm of empowerment and participation. This is fundamental. That's why, and I'm very proud to say from as in my capacity as Vice President of the Commission for Social Development this year and for the Commission, Vice President of the Commission on the Status of Women, that this year, thanks God, there was a consistency in the identification and setting up of the thematic priorities of those two commissions, saying two very important things. In the Commission for Social Development was, we need to empower people, not just one group or the other group. It's all the people. And in the case of the Commission on the Status of Women, we do the same. I mean, of course, in nature come from gender perspective, we need to empower women. These are two powerful ideas that need to be connected. And why? Because we are in the middle of negotiation for the post-agenda 2015. And in that agenda, we are simply seeing the following. Many years ago, we have a very large set of international commitment on development that never, you know, were achieved. So we decided, okay, we put this all this commitment to the trash can, and we will have just 8 goals, thinking that, oh, okay, 8 goals is enough. We will get it very easily. And look what happened 15 years later. I mean, it's very small list of countries who really can tell the world that they achieved the 8 simple Millennium Development Goals. So if we're not able to get not even 8 goals, what's going on with us? Is development a serious thing or not? Then, of course, we need to go on the idea of the inclusion of civil society actors, but from the beginning of the process. I mean, you and myself need to be involved personally this is a personal matter. I'm joking all the time, I know, but I like to say my fellow colleagues in my mission, listen, guys, I'm supporting the elder issue because when I get there, and very quickly and soon, I want to make sure that I'll be treated with dignity and respect. So for me, it's a personal matter. It's not that the government just asked me. Of course, my government asked me that. But I also take it as a person, as a personally. Because it's, I mean, I'm going to get there, hopefully, hopefully. And we, what we do in Latin America, we knock the good. But we never know. But this is something that is very close to all of us in a personal matter. So please consider that approach, and you will see that acting together, whatever creativity we have, we can do the difference. And of course that, you know, as anything in politics and social and development and in life, if we are acting together, we will have, of course, a critical mass of support to this idea, and we need it. We need it because we are facing obstacles that are beyond the common understanding and the common sense, and that's the problem. You know, we have a saying in Latin America, say that the common sense is the most uncommon sense that the human has. And that's, I mean, that's amazing, but how we are investing so much in areas and weapons, destroying our planet, but not in ourselves as human beings. So that's not common sense. And I'm sure that all of you, all, and including myself, think that this is not possible. I mean, we need to change this path, or we are directly to destroy all of us very quickly. And please go to the next slide. Then, so what we did, or what we're doing as El Salvador, first, of course, we started to work on this idea on the convention since last year. And I had to say that we present, of course, a draft resolution for the consideration of member state here at the UN. But second, I have to pay tribute and recognize also the very active support of the First Lady of El Salvador, Dr. Wanda Piñato. She has been the driving force behind all the El Salvador efforts on this matter. In, I would like to say that our First Lady is not only the First Lady. For us, and she in fact is also the Minister of Social Inclusion, so it's not a welfare approach, it's a human rights approach, and it's a public policy behind what we are trying to do. So that's why it's important to have, of course, a person who has two hats, the hats or her role as a minister who can see the public policy need to be implemented, and of course, as I said, the most powerful person in the government, more than the president, because it's the woman, it's the First Lady. So in that regard, it's a very good opportunity for us to work with her, and she and her leadership in the context of Latin America and the Caribbean has been crucial to move this issue further. But we need to work more on forming and creating alliances with the international civil society. Because, again, this is a matter that is not just a discussion or a theoretical or conceptual discussion. If you look at what happened, for example, on the context of other vulnerable group, we have Convention for the Right of the Child, which is good. We have CEDAW for women issues, excellent. We have a Convention on Person with Disability, great, because we are also dealing with that. We have a very good declaration on indigenous community or indigenous people, wonderful. But what about the older person? So we are, in a way, creating a second-class vulnerable group within our own house, and that's not possible. I mean, if we are going to be consistent with what we are saying here at the UN, we need to move in the direction of providing equal treatment to everyone. It's a simple thing. It's a, again, it's a common sense issue. Now, finally, we managed on December 2012 to adopt our resolution A/RES/67/139. That resolution is very important, and I would like to say, please, in the next slide, that had the support of 25 countries as co-sponsor. most of them Latin American, but I would like to show you the next slide, please. A figure that maybe, or an image that maybe gives you a sense of what we're talking about. Well, the green line, or the green countries, are those who voted in favor of the resolution. The yellow one, those who abstain, and the red one, those who oppose the resolution. So if we look at the planet in that way, I don't know, to me, it's a very interesting picture of where the world is moving right now. So I would like to tell you that I'm the person, or the kind of person, who like to see the full glass, not the empty one. And if that's the case, in the American context, the majority are the green color. So my task is to fight to making sure that the rest of the American, at least, become green. Why don't we have this slogan, make America's green? Well, we have also a challenge in the other part of the planet. But I think it's doable. I'm convinced of it. And I'm convinced of it because in the next slash, I will just like to put some of the partners that we already have with civil society to go in this direction. I'm sure there are some of them, not all of them. But that's the point. We need to make sure that everyone is involved. And this is not a matter of El Salvador. It's a matter of everyone. If you consider that perspective, you will realize that we're in the same boat. I mean, so we don't. What we have to lose? Nothing except the dignity that we already have as human beings. And I'm pretty sure that is not the intention of all of us. Next slide, please. And what is the contribution of this resolution? Very concrete is the following. First, we extend the mandate of the working group. So therefore, from starting this August, we will be able to receive inputs on the elements that contain a new international instrument. So we open the window. It's just the beginning. And because it's just the beginning, we, of course, need the support of everyone. We recently received a very important letter from Secretary General asking us to comply and provide input and information from our own government of what we think would be, this kind of convention. My country did it. I mean, we provide the inputs. I know many others do the same. But my request for you today would be, please ask your mission or your country where you come from if they already send that information to the Secretariat. Let's start by the simple thing. Just send a note. Even if you're opposed to the whole idea of having a resolution, say it. Put it in a paper and send it to the Secretary General. I mean, if we're going to discuss something, it's important to know where everybody is or stand on this point. If you're opposed, say it. It's fine. I mean, nobody's going to criticize you, but it's going to be a very good opportunity to everyone to start a dialogue. That's what suppose the UN is doing, creating spaces and platform for dialogue. We are not asking anything else. We are not imposing anything else. We just ask for dialogue. Let's discuss this matter. As simple as that. I don't know. I mean, UN, if UN can do that, I don't think nobody else can do that. I quote a sentence from the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He was saying, "You cannot end poverty without empowering women and girls. You cannot establish lasting peace without respect for human rights. You cannot increase prosperity or address climate change without transforming the world's energy system. We have to advance on all fronts." Ban Ki-moon, he's right. And we can say we can end poverty without empowering women and girls, in our view, is women and all cycle of life. Because again, if we are only have women and girls, that means that he's referring only from women to what? To 15 to 50 years old, 60 years old. What about the rest? It can be sent to any other planet? I don't know. Unless we are able to send all these people to the international, facility outer space. But if not the case, we need to do something. Because, and that's the problem again, we need to have a coherent manner to see the problems, an integrated all the perspective on development. So it's not a matter of women and girls. It's a matter of women and men in all the cycle of their life. That's the approach that will make the difference. So, okay, let's say Secretary General is going in the 80% of the good direction. Let's make sure that he reach the 20% that is missing now. And finally, just like to express my sincere appreciation for listening to me. Please don't quote me. I know they're going to fire me if they listen to what I'm saying. So, because I know I'm talking to a friend, a human friend, I'm so joking and I have the liberty to say many things that I've formally, probably, I will say it, but, you know, in a more eloquent way, especially in Spanish, because I'm fluent in Spanish anymore. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Carlos Garcia. I'd now like to give the floor to Ms. Elizabeth Nyland. Ms. Nyland comes to us today from our partner for this event, the Division for Social Policy and Development of DESA. She's the Associate Affairs Officer in the Social Integration Branch and focuses on youth issues in her work. Welcome to the panel, Ms. Nyland. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Gail, and thank you, DPI, for inviting me to this event. I've been at a number of these events so far, so I'm beginning to see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, which is most of them quite welcoming, which is great. And thank you, Ambassador. It's always great to follow a presentation that is so in-depth and based on so much knowledge and experience, because it makes my job a lot easier. As Gail mentioned, I come from the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and within that I'm based within the Social Integration Branch, and it's quite an interesting branch to work for, and I'm not just saying that because some of my colleagues are at the back of the room, but in part because it combines the units of the family, the unit of youth, and the unit of aging, which is essentially kind of what this entire briefing here today is about social integration and intergenerational solidarity. So we've got a quite unique perspective on these units working together under the same kind of umbrella. But we hear the word, and you know, we've spoken about this, Gail and the Ambassador mentioned the word social integration, and we hear it bandied about a lot. You know, what exactly is social integration? I know when I go home and I try to explain my work to some of my family members, and they just kind of look at me blankly and go, what are you on about? But essentially, as we mentioned, social integration is really trying to create a society for all. You know, whether you have a disability, whether you come from an Indigenous background, regardless of your religion, your ethnicity, whether you're a woman. And this also includes a society of all ages, whether you're young, whether you're old, or like me, whether you're anything in between. So that's kind of essentially what we're talking about. It's not kind of some big complex idea. It's really just creating a society where we can all live together in harmony. But, you know, I was asked to speak about this from a youth perspective because I work in the youth unit of the Social Integration Branch. I was also told before I came on the panel, you will be the young person on the panel. According to the UN, I'm not officially a young person because that's age 15 to 24. Also, according to my own family, I'm not getting any younger. So I'm not sure I can give a specific youth perspective, but I have worked for youth organizations for a long time, and hopefully I can give you kind of some insight into that. So when we talk, we mentioned briefly earlier about the importance of looking at intergenerational solidarity really from that kind of from an intergenerational perspective. So not looking at it in regards to kind of competition between the generations, which is what happens a lot. I know from my own experience working with youth organizations, we would often, you know, kind of be like, no, we need to just focus on youth. I mean, this is what we're doing. But we also need to kind of be cognizant of the fact that, you know, regardless of where you are in the kind of the generational spectrum, you have specific and unique challenges that face you, whether you're younger or older and so forth. So I'd like to talk about some of the kind of specific youth challenges that are happening kind of in the here and now. Many of you are aware of these, Young people compose 1.2 billion of the world's population, which is quite a significant amount. And this number is set to peak within the next 20 years, so a growing youth population. We've all kind of been, if you've been opening the papers for the last few years, some of the main headlines you're hearing are about high levels of youth unemployment, high levels of youth migration, youth participation, and demands for youth participation across the globe. So young people always have all been agents for change, but specifically over the last few years, we're hearing more demands from young people that we want to be better integrated, we want to have our say, and we want to participate in society economically, civically, and politically. I'm just going to kind of talk about three main things. The first one is youth unemployment. In 2012 alone, there were 75 million young people who were deemed unemployed. That's 41% of the global working population, which is really quite an alarming figure when you think of it in that context. The economic and financial crisis have no doubt had a huge impact to play on that, but there are other factors kind of to take into account as well, including the education system, this mismatch between what skills are you learning in school and university, and how well are you equipped to meet the demands of the labour market when you then begin to enter the labour force. So not only are young people often leaving education already knowing that unemployment statistics are very high, but also with this knowledge that, well, maybe what I've learned won't be any good to me when I go to look for a job. So they're kind of some of the main issues. When we look at what that high level of youth unemployment is doing in terms of intergenerational solidarity, and I mean, I'm sure many of you here are familiar with younger people within your own families, or you as a young person yourself. If you're not able to find a job, you don't have an income, you can't support yourself in terms of rent, in terms of very kind of basic everyday necessities, many young people are either forced to stay at home or to move back to home to live with families, which then in turn has an impact upon the financial situation of their parents, who may themselves be living on, in often cases, quite meagre pensions. And this really places a whole kind of other strain upon what would traditionally be kind of intergenerational dialogue within a family and intergenerational, multi-generational living. It, of course, also delays the life stages of young people. If I don't have a job, if I don't have money, I'm less likely to be able to buy my own house, to be able to consider, marriage, to be able to consider having children. And so you're delaying these kind of very important life stages for young people to a later stage. And of course, depending as well on your view of intergenerational, I suppose it depends on everybody's individual family as well, but, some people don't mind moving back home, other people put fear into them, the idea of moving back home as well. So, depending on what your kind of perspective is on intergenerational dialogue within your family, this can have very, very different results. The other side of this unemployment coin is the issue of youth migration. So for young people who decide, I'm not moving back home, I'm going to try and migrate and try and find a job somewhere else, we're seeing increasing levels of youth migration. In 2010, there were 27 million young people who migrated, and this is about 12.5% of the global migration number, which again is quite a significant percent, and that's young people aged 15 to 24. If you look at young people, if we call them young people, up to age 34, that number goes up to 30%, which is, again, quite high. And I know I've got three cousins from the same family, three boys who all migrated to Australia, leaving my poor aunt alone. So I'm sure many of you have similar tales of family members having to go abroad to find work. This has historically happened all the time. I myself am a migrant, but I chose to be a migrant. I didn't do so out of economic necessity. I did so for other reasons. But when you're forced to migrate out of economic necessity, it puts a whole different perspective on your migration experience. And of course, this has an impact on intergenerational solidarity, on intergenerational dialogue. Skyping home once a week is great, but it's clearly going to have a much different effect on what type of relationship your grandchildren will have with you if your migrant children have migrated and so forth. The other thing that I would like to talk about is the issue of girls and young women. In many places in the world, there's been huge advancements and gains in terms of empowerment of young women. In other places, not nearly enough. So the picture really varies across the globe. But when we talk about girls and young women from the perspective of where more girls and young women are entering the labour market, are becoming empowered, this is having a huge impact, again, on intergenerational relations and solidarity within the home, within the family. Traditionally, girls and young women have been considered as the primary caregivers to both children and to elderly parents. So looking at it from that perspective, you know, again, I was at an event recently at the Intergenerational Subcommittee, and one of the speakers spoke about how traditionally in her society she would have been expected to stay at home, but that was no longer the case. And she said, well, you know, I mean, I will finance my parents' retirement, living in retirement home, but I don't want to go back. I want to continue working. And I want to continue working abroad. So the changing nature of what it means to have traditional caregivers within the home and who these are is changing. And there is a huge need for policies and programs to be able to meet these changing roles, to be able to meet these changing kind of traditions where that is taking place. And that leads me on to policies and programs. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail because the ambassador covered the Madrid Plan of Action quite nicely, and I know that Donna and Teresa will talk a little bit more about specific programming and activities at community and local level and so forth. But I will mention the importance of policies and programs at a national level and at the international level in encouraging practices that promote better intergenerational solidarity and foster intergenerational dialogue. As we mentioned, the Madrid Plan of Action 2002 speaks to this. Also does the World Programme of Action for Youth, which was adopted in 1995 and in 2007 had an additional priority area of intergenerational partnerships included in this. And that speaks to bolstering intergenerational solidarity, investment and empowerment of youth, as well as investment in girls and young women. So back to what we're talking about. How can we promote policies that encourage the advancement of young people, but even if you look at this more globally, how can we encourage policies, the advancement of people, while still allowing for intergenerational solidarity and relationships to be fostered and to take place? And then I will be killed if I don't mention the International Year of the Family's anniversary, which is taking place next year. And again, our family unit works on that. And a lot of this cuts right to the core of, you know, what it is to foster intergenerational relationships. Most of this happens for us in quite an informal context within the family, regardless of kind of what that family structure might be. But again, I'm talking from a youth perspective. So I will have to kind of stress the importance of when we look about kind of what's happening with young people throughout the world today, you can't expect development and economic growth and social integration more generally to happen unless we invest in young people. So long as young people are unemployed, so long as young people don't have their voices heard, aren't involved in participatory processes, as long as girls and young women aren't allowed to participate, then we won't have social integration. So investment in young people is key, and that is exactly what the World Programme of Action for Youth promotes. It's a guide for at the national level for member states to develop national policies and action plans related to youth development. Again, at the UN level, youth is, and, you know, increasingly we're hearing member states, as society in general, realise that we need to better invest in young people. You cannot have integration without investment in young people. The UN... last year, the Secretary General announced his 5-year action agenda for his second term, and one of his priorities in that was working with and for women and young people. So the UN has really highlighted that we are making investment in young people a priority. There are a number of initiatives underneath that. I don't want to go into them in too much detail because that's not exactly the point of this today, but just to mention them quickly was the development, and what's being developed is a UN system-wide action plan on youth. There was the appointment of an envoy on youth, and there is development of a UN youth volunteer program. So this is the UN's effort to better engage with and for young people. I can give you more details on that over email for anybody who's interested. That's kind of the main point, I guess, I want to make from this perspective is For social integration to be successful, for intergenerational solidarity to be successful, you need to invest in young people. If I'm a young person and I am not empowered, if I don't have a job, if I don't have any recourse to participate, I will not come to an intergenerational encounter on an equal basis as somebody else. And I think for anything to be successful, you need to come there from an equal footing. Both younger people and older people, and like I said, everybody in between, you need to be empowered, you need to feel that you have some ownership over your own life course. And again, I know Donna will talk a little bit more about kind of the different schemes and activities that take place around that. But there is a huge role for social integration, social integration and intergenerational solidarity in this investment in youth. We talk about mentoring schemes in the employment context. I mean, that's a really great way of investing in young people, but also leveraging the power of intergenerational solidarity to do so. So mentoring between older workers and younger workers. Volunteer activities, another great example of where you can have people across the generations coming together to exchange skills and knowledge. So certainly when we talk about investment in youth, we can also look at it from from an intergenerational solidarity perspective. Finally, I just want to, this is going back to the family, I just want to talk before I end, just kind of end it on a positive note or a self-learning note, shall we say. We all come from multi-generational families, or for the most part, multi-generational families. We've all different experiences with those families. They can go very well, they can go not so well, and so forth. We're all aware of that. But we all do have these very personal experiences. So there's a lot that you can do as a young person, as an older person, to really promote intergenerational solidarity, whether it be within your home or within your community. And I know just one example, this goes back to me being a quite young and naive university student, maybe about 21, and I have this vivid memory of taking a bus home from town in Dublin one day and seeing this older gentleman walking home, and he was quite hunched over. He had some shopping in his hand, like maybe a pint of milk and some sausages or something, and my heart for 2 days just bled. I just thought, he's so lonely, and I was just so upset by seeing this old man. I had no clue. He could have been as happy as Larry. I had no basis for this, only my own social perception of what it was to be an older person. Having come to the UN and working, and I know there's a couple of friendly faces, Ed and Helen, who work in the intergenerational subcommittee of the NGO Committee on the Aging, my perspective has just been turned on its head completely. I've seen that subcommittee work tirelessly on the issues that are important to them, and I've been involved in it, and I've always been so amazed at the work that they're doing and the energy they have, and that's not even from any kind of generational perspective, but just even in comparison to my own energy levels often. But that these type of experiences, very informal experience often, that shape how you think about intergenerational solidarity and dialogue are so, so important. So I no longer kind of have that view of what it is to be older, just based on working with this amazing, amazing group of people. So fostering those type of dialogues within your family, within your community, are really key. We can talk about the big policies and programs, but small steps like that we take individually are so, so important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth Mallon. Moving on now, it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to Ms. Donna Butts. And it's very interesting that we should have someone who was on the actual video actually on the podium. She's the Executive Director of Generations United in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Donna, for traveling up to be with us and to speak with us today on the International Day of the Families. You have the floor.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on this distinguished panel. I really appreciate the invitation and an opportunity to be a part of this important day that really celebrates the family and the important roles that families of all types play in supporting civil society and the compact between generations. And that's a key to our work at Generations United, to move that conversation from competition to cooperation, from competition between generations to cooperation, and realizing that we all live in a family, and it's not a fight, it's a family, and to use that frame in the conversations we have about policy and program. And it was also a delight to be able to watch the video. Thank you very much for using that. One of the reasons that I personally love it is because we filmed it about a year before my father passed away, and the older gentleman at the end who's smiling is my father. So if you have a chance to look at it again on our website at Generations United or on YouTube, just look for that smiling face, and that's my daddy butts. So today what I want to do is really touch briefly on intergenerational programs and intergenerational families and recommend a paper that I was very fortunate and very honored to work on with two colleagues, Ling Ling Tang in Singapore and Alan Hatton Yeo in the UK. And we wrote a paper on intergenerational solidarity in support of the 20th anniversary of the International Day of Family next year. It takes a much more in-depth look at a global look at the policies and programs that are needed to really support intergenerational solidarity. So today I want to first start with intergenerational programs, and it's absolutely wonderful. I feel, Elizabeth, like you've touched on most of my talking points. Thank you. It's great that we can that we are supporting and reinforcing each other. But what we found is that intergenerational programs actually encourage intergenerational solidarity in families. Dr. Tang found intergenerational programs provide a platform for developing positive relationships across generations and strengthening the quality of ties between family members. A study in Europe found that younger people engaged in intergenerational programs showed more interest in their own older family members. So that engagement across generations outside of the family supports the family. So intergenerational programs vary around the globe and around the U.S., but they generally fall into one of four categories. So I'll share those with you. The first is young serving old, and we've all seen programs where younger people are teaching older people how to use computers, how to use their cell phones, how to set up their Facebook pages so they can stay connected to their grandchildren. They also do home safety inspections, household chores, or help older immigrants study for their citizenship exams. So young serving old. Old serving young are found also in many different varieties, whether it's tutoring in schools, mentoring teen mothers, or providing safe passage for children who are walking to school, being those crossing guards, those safety keepers in a community. And then there's old and young serving together. And a great example of that is in St. Louis in the U.S., a program called Meal Runners. What they realized was that their older Meals on Wheels drivers were having difficulty lifting and carrying and doing some of the things that they needed to do to serve the meals. So they recruited young people, and now older and younger teams in St. Louis through Meal Runners deliver the Meals on Wheels. So the older volunteers may pack the meals, the younger people load the meals, the young people run in, deliver the meals, and it's really one of those win-win. There also are a number of programs where older adults are teaching or mentoring in science and math and a number of subjects. And then fourth, what we call intergenerational shared sites, and that's what the video really showed. Whether it's a facility, as you saw in the video, what we know is that those kinds of programs make sense while saving dollars. They save dollars while they make sense. So we really encourage that kind of interaction. They're all developed with intention, with respect, and reciprocity for the strengths of each generation. Because as Elizabeth and the ambassador pointed out, it is important that we keep all generations in mind and realize that each has something important to contribute. And that when we're thinking about our program development, it requires us to use an intergenerational lens. I can't look at any issue or opportunity without thinking about how can we engage people of all ages in addressing this, and how, as a society and as a world, can we not engage the human capital that is created in this incredible globe that we live on. So second, what I wanted to touch on was really the increasing role and the increasingly important role that older adults are playing in families. In the U.S. alone, nearly 7 million children live in multi-generational households that are headed either by a grandparent or another relative. 2.7 million grandparents report that they have total responsibility for the children that are living with them. Now, these grand families, as we call them, grand families, are saving U.S. taxpayers more than $6.5 billion a year because they're keeping those children out of the child welfare system. And they're doing what families do best. They're raising another generation. They're caring for another generation. So while there have been some supportive policies that have been enacted, such as the National Family Caregiver Support Program that provides supports and care for family like respite, and the more recent Fostering Connections for Success Act that provides a subsidy for relatives raising children as those children exit the foster care system, there's still so much more that we need to do to support caregivers. And in addition to full-time care, we're seeing grandparents who are more and more engaged in providing either full or part-time child care that are enabling their adult children to work or go to school. Others are providing financial support, paying tuition, buying reliable transportation so their children can work and support the family, or helping with basic necessities. Now, oftentimes they are choosing to do that, but what we have to be aware of is that oftentimes they're also putting their own safety at risk, their own financial security at risk. So again, it's that interconnection of the families. Now, outside the U.S., we see these phenomena as well. In Singapore and Malaysia, for example, they have what they call weekend parents. The children are left with the grandparents during the week, and the parents then parent on the weekend when they're not working. In rural China, where there's a high migration for work, 20% of elders provide full-time care for an estimated 58 million children who are left behind by their parents. So as I said, many of the grandparents do this most willingly. Most do it because when they're asked, the bottom line is it's family. I've never met a grandparent when confronted with taking in a grandchild would say no, because it's their grandchild, it's their family. So again, to think about it in that cohesive way. So to do that, we need to make sure that our family policies include family members of all generations. And that includes grandfamilies, it includes older adults, because oftentimes when we think of family policy, we stop at the parent generation. We don't think about the older generations and the active engagement that it requires of all generations. There's an anthropologist who I dearly care for named Dr. Mary Catherine Bateson. And Dr. Bateson is the daughter of Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead. And one of the things that Dr. Bateson has said is that we're living longer and we're thinking shorter. We're living longer, but we're thinking shorter. So she's on a personal mission to make sure that elders claim their role and make sure that they're supporting and contributing to the next generation. And it's that grandparent advantage that has really helped propel our societies forward. It's that ability to recycle human knowledge, understanding, culture, and experience that benefits future generations. Intergenerational solidarity is essential for healthy families and healthy society. So I have three quick recommendations that I wanted to leave you with. We really encourage countries and governments and communities, states, parishes, to think about creating ministries of intergenerational solidarity or an office for children, youth, older adults, and families, so that we're looking in a cohesive, unified way at the policies and supports that are needed across the generations. That will protect generations, and it'll help to build new alliances between those who work on their behalf. We need to review family policies with that intergenerational lens to ensure that they're inclusive, they support grandfamilies and other non-traditional families. And I call on us to use the 20th anniversary of the International Day of the Family to encourage countries to promote intergenerational dialogues and mutual understanding. When properly planned, those dialogues can increase understanding and raise awareness about the importance of families for the well-being of all our societies. And promote intergenerational centers, both the centers and natural use of space that encourage us to interact. We have done so much to segregate by age. We need to now make sure that we're integrating and we're intentionally integrating. So in closing, I'd like to thank the Department of Public Information, the Division of Social Policy and Development for organizing this important discussion, and encourage everyone here to continue the conversation, to speak out on behalf of intergenerational solidarity between and among generations whenever you see it threatened. And I'd give you one opportunity that's coming up here in New York. On June 5th, Pfizer's Claim Your Age campaign is going to hold Claim Your Age Day in Times Square. and they're going to have tents set up, they're going to have jumbotrons, and you can go in and claim your age and do it on behalf of another generation. So it's a great opportunity. I encourage you to go to Times Square, claim your age, and say you're doing it for intergenerational solidarity. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Lots of great ideas. I hope you've put all those things down, the last three in particular, and marked June 5th on your calendar. Our final speaker for this morning is Teresa Knox. She's the program director of the Intergenerational Work Study Program at the Department of Aging right here in New York City. Thank you so much for being with us, Ms. Knox.
Thank you.
The floor is yours.
For having me. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for inviting me today to address the UN's International Day of Families relating to advancing social integration and intergenerational solidarity. All of these components are equally important, and I'm just going to start briefly by reading just the mission of New York City Department for the Aging, which is to work for the empowerment, independence, dignity, quality of life for all New York City's diverse older adults, and to support their families through advocacy, education, and the coordination of delivery of services. And the reason why I wanted to just start off with mentioning the mission of the Department for the Aging is because they answer the question why we, an aging service agency, involve ourselves in intergenerational initiatives. First, the Department for the Aging's intergenerational programs are central to our mission's work for the benefit of New York City's diverse older adults and their families, because they promote opportunities for older adults, a vast, untapped social resource, to share their leadership, knowledge, and skills to benefit New Yorkers of all ages. And we do it for another reason, because aging issues and intergenerational issues are often inseparable. The department utilizes its role as New York City's aging service agency to address and raise awareness of intergenerational intersections on matters of not just old and the older generations, but to all generations, which is Donna's theme, Generations United. So inevitably, to the beneficial of all participants, the individual programs are important. They serve larger social purposes for vehicles of awareness, understanding, and exchange across intergenerational lines. And for interdisciplinary and interorganizational collaborations that strengthen policy making, program planning, and they strengthen the delivery of service to constituents of all ages. The Department for the Aging has been involved in intergenerational initiatives for well over 30 years, starting with the foster grandparent in 1975. In 1987, then-Commissioner Janice Sainer, an anonymous donor, and the New York City Department of Education, the Board of Ed then, collaborated to pilot a program, the Intergenerational Work Study Program, a combined aging services and high school dropout prevention serving both elders and youth. In 1994, the department established the Grandparent Resource Center, which assists grandparents who are raising their grandchildren by providing information, case management, and counseling services. The center also helps community-based organizations maintain and start grandparent support groups. Each of these initiatives are sustained to this day through a combined combination of public and private funding, interagency partnerships, and the support of the Aging Services Network. But the Intergenerational Work Study Program, which I have been a part of for the last 21 years, is a collaboration between New York City Department for the Aging and New York City Department of Education. And it has expanded its mission over the last 26 years. The Work Study Program is a service learning program which contributes to public education and aging services in New York. It integrates academic study with work experience for high school students who deliver needed service to elders throughout the city in senior centers, nursing homes, and in home care settings. while drawing on the skills of elders in all of these centers' settings as mentors. The exchange has built bridges between generations, teaching the young to respect and to learn from their elders. It gives the elders the opportunity to know, learn, and mentor the younger generation. But in order to enjoy and achieve the kind of success that and longevity that we have had, you have to bring together two populations, the youth and the seniors. They are the ones that are bridging the gaps between the generations. They are the ones that are strengthening our communities. And they are the ones that are learning from each other. This is an unprecedented 26-year partnership between public education and aging services. It just works. The principals of the high schools love the programs because it's not only a well-structured program, but it provides another opportunity for their students to take active roles in their communities in new ways. Sometimes the students are the service providers, and at other times they are the recipients of the guidance and wisdom and affection of the elders who have many pearls of wisdom. This program encourages young people in lifelong civic engagement. Intergenerational programs are mutually beneficial for both populations. As Donna said, it's just a win-win situation. And I'm also going to quote Ambassador Gonzalez when he said, "It has to be personal. And for me, it's very personal. You have to want to be involved in intergenerational programming and believe in its effectiveness." So I want to thank you for this opportunity to share this information about the Intergenerational Work Study Program and the department's work in intergenerational programming. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Thank you, Ms. Marks. The floor is now open for questions. Remember to identify yourself and your organization before you ask a question. And of course, because of the topic, I'm sure there are going to be more statements than questions, but we welcome that exchange. Neil.
Neil Blunstein, Universal Esperanto Association. I've heard a lot of statements about the need for youth to have work and the need for work. A basic element of family is free time or paid vacation together. Different countries, companies have different laws. For example, I suspect that most UN employees have 1 month paid vacations. I lived in Brazil, a country much poorer than the United States, where they enforce a 30-day paid vacation system. Are there countries where young mothers have no vacations, no maternity leave, and where rising retirement ages would not allow a lot of the conversation that you discussed about grandparents raising children if there are no retirement ages? How do vacations affect your family life? What are the rules in El Salvador? Do you follow U.S. rules? Thank you.
A lot of questions, Neil. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. In the front. Mm-hmm.
My name is Daniel Conway. I'm with Manhattanville College. My questions are in reference to Mrs. Nyland. Did I get your name right? Okay, that's good. Being a member of what you would define as youth and being unemployed in what my mother would consider her beloved ne'er-do-well, the issue of youth unemployment interests me. Now, when you said development with the UN is pushing for, an increased youth development, did you mean education or did you mean government? Did you mean, providing jobs directly?
I hear you. Next to you? Mm-hmm. Just push the button. Right.
Hi. Good now morning.
That's fine.
I just want to thank all the panelists for coming along and talking to us. My name is Shantanu Roy, and I'm representing City College of New York. My question for Ambassador Enriquez. So you talked a little bit about women empowerment and their participation in the civil societies. As you may know, that there are many countries around the world where there are patriarchal societies where women are heavily oppressed and they're denied the access to hold a job, right? So what recommendations would you give to the international communities to help solve this disparity and further empower women? Thank you. And I promise you, your answer will not go out of this room.
Thank you. I'm glad you have that power. Because it's being webcast, by the way, right at the back of the room. Wait, just wait. When you put the microphone on, just for everybody, just wait until it turns red. When it turns red, it's on.
Audrey Braver, Altruis International. I just have a comment for Ms. Knox. I live in a NORC community in Long Island City, and we participate in the intergenerational program with Frank Sinatra High School. And it is one of the most enjoyable, entertaining, educational experiences. I look forward to those 2 hours every week. The children, these Gen Y kids, are a love. They really are. And I just want to say that I hope it continues.
Thank you so much. I'm going to take two other questions and then we'll deal with answers. There's one on the left. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Cristina Napolitano. I'm representing International Federation for Family Development. And first, I wanted to thank you for your presentations because it has a different flair than the usual meetings at the UN. But I wanted to ask you something and making a little bit of also relation to what I live at home. I'm here working right now, but I'm also a mother and I have children. And many times when they ask me, Mom, can I have more ice cream? I'm like, did you eat some already? And they say, yes. It's like, remember, always balance. You know, we always use the word balance at home. And one of my children the other day said, but Mom, balance is impossible. And I was thinking, yeah, probably it's not that it's impossible, but it's difficult to achieve a balance. And that is why I want to connect this to today, because when we are in the Commission of Women, for example, trying to empower women, saying many things, good things, you know, so women are not in the stage that you are mentioning. And it's so good for women to get jobs and to get out there. And at the same time, we don't want the other thing that you were mentioning, that then who takes care of those children or who takes care of their parents. How can I feel intergenerational solidarity can help bring policies that really find a balance where you can work and at the same time be with your children, you can work and help your grandparents or have your grandparents help you out, you know. And I feel that this is a way where we can get into balance and have policies that can reach that balance. Do you agree with that? Or do you have any examples, any of you, that you have seen in policies that can achieve that balance? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Last one on this side. I'm going to come back. You're on.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Suzanne Bleiberg-Sepperson, and I'm here representing Generations United and also the Intergenerational Center at Dowling College on Long Island. My question is as follows. If any of you have any strategic advice how to implement some intergenerational programs, specifically, and this is for Ms. Teresa Knox, would you recommend that in terms of advocating for policies that we start with the agencies who are usually short-staffed and don't want additional work, and particularly because Long Island has, you know, two counties, Nassau and Suffolk. Do we start with the agencies? Do we start with the politicians? There are many intergenerational programs that come from the high schools with local communities, but how do we make it or what would you suggest that we do to, let's say, create policies at the New York State level to create funding so that it's not isolated kinds of programs? And then I will just add, in response to the last speaker's question about balance, one of my personal advocacies, which I think would work on a national level, at least here in the United States, would be the implementation of the support of the government for job sharing between the young and the old, because many young mothers would love to work, don't want to drop out of the job market, but don't want to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week. Many of the seniors, at least until recently, would love to back off a little bit, but can't because of fear of losing their health care. So if you have some concrete advice as to how to make these advances happen on a political way, I'd be very appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you so much for all your very interesting questions. So panel, I'm going to put it out to you. The first question from Neil, and I don't know if you want to take this, Liz, but he asked about free and paid vacations. Are there countries with no retirement age? I don't think that there are countries with no retirement age. Retirement ages differ from country to country. But and the same thing with maternity benefits and you know, all those things. They all are there. They just vary from country to country. But I'm going to let Elizabeth talk more about that in response to his question.
Oh, it is ready to go. Yeah, I mean, I would agree with what Gail says. I mean, this differs really from country to country. I don't have a list in front of me, unfortunately, of kind of how much that varies or what country is doing what. But, you know, it would be pretty easy to kind of get a lot of that information. But no doubt, and this relates, again, to the question, if I can, is it okay for me to kind
sure.
of model Sorry. Questions and answers? This relates to the question slightly about women in the workplace and how that's changing kind of caregiving roles, and this goes back to the kind of the idea as well of whether it's paid vacation, what age you retire, what policies are in place to enable people to be productive members of society, for development to take place, but also to allow intergenerational relations to be fostered. You know, if you've got childcare arrangements or you've got government-supported childcare, if you have adequate pension systems, if you've got equal pay for both men and women, if you've got decent standards of living, it's, of course, a lot easier to be able to foster those relationships within the home, to be able to make intergenerational relationships work. When you don't have those things in place, when you're struggling from day to day just to be able to, you know, put bread on your table, when you can't afford childcare, when it makes more sense for you not to work but to stay at home because the childcare costs are so enormous, then, you know, you're coming up with a plethora of challenges in terms of intergenerational relationships. But, yeah, I mean, to give you specific kind of, as Gail said, examples of different retirement ages, whether or not there's paid vacation and so forth, I would have to, you know, kind of get back to you on that.
The next question was also for you on youth employment.
I'll just keep the mic for the rest of the day. Yeah, sorry, I didn't actually. Despite the glasses being on, I'm having a hard time figuring out where the voices are coming from. They're not in my head. So the question was on youth employment. Yeah, so there's two things, and your question asked about those two things. When I speak about the youth or the UN making youth employment a priority, or youth more generally a priority, what I mentioned earlier was the SG's action agenda for his second term, his five-year action agenda, and one of the priorities was working with and for young people, and those three initiatives that I mentioned, one of them being the development of a UN system-wide action plan on youth. There's a few thematic areas underneath that. Employment, entrepreneurship are two of them, and this would relate exactly to what you're talking about, as well as education, including on sexual and reproductive health, protection of rights, civic engagement, and so forth. What's happening on that front is that UN entities are getting together to develop a system-wide action plan on youth, which essentially means they're collaborating and coordinating the work they're doing on youth issues at the international, regional, country levels. So we're working together to come up with, and it's not, the webpage should be available pretty soon, and again, we can circulate that, which gives more detail as to exactly what this is, but it's a way for entities to work together to better ensure that these things, on projects they're working on, to better ensure this coordination and collaboration. And a lot of those projects would relate to, because employment is one of the key areas of that system-wide action plan, would relate to specific activities and measures at the country level and activities related to that. So you would, you know, obviously, yeah, you would have to kind of look into that, and we can talk about that a bit later. So we are, you know, we're pushing that as one of the priority areas of the system-wide action plan. In regards to within the UN specifically, I mean, there are a few things, and we obviously get asked this a lot. I remember when I was working for NGOs, I also asked this a lot. But, you know, there's the Young Professional Program of the UN Secretariat. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that's an annual competition for countries that are under or non-represented within the UN that young people under the age of 32 can apply for within their field category, within their study category, to go through an exam process and enter the UN system as a young professional. There's also the Junior Professional Program, the JPO, and different programs for different entities. There's also internships that you can apply for as well, which are, you know, kind of roughly about 3 to 4 months. But, I mean, more what we're talking about when we're talking about youth employment is kind of at the national, the government level, what entities are doing on the ground. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the one on patriarchal societies and the whole question of what recommendations, Ambassador, would you have for patriarchal societies on the empowerment of women?
Thank you very much, and I will take the advantage of the promise that I will not be quote. If that's the case, I also have to take the liberty to respond to the all questions raised here from a different perspective. I'm not going to put it out specifically, but I would like to have a reflection on the whole question, because they are all related, and we need to consider it as an integrated manner. The first thing I would like to say is that with regards to the employment, youth employment, and all of this stuff, pay vacation, things like that, it's just the following thinking. First, we need to connect all the discussions or the positions that we have in this house, the UN, because there is a huge disconnection between discussion on the second committee, for example, that deals with macroeconomic policy, financial institution, World Trade Organization, the fifth committee, that of course deals with the very important matters related to financial programs that the UN as a system will finance and provide budget to, or provide the money to do the things. And of course, discussion on the social issues, politics, empowerment of people. And there is a huge disconnection, because we tend to believe that the economy is something that comes from heaven and is not related to people. And because, you know, some big entrepreneurship or some very good business guy have or know everything in the planet, and they can rule as they wish. That's the first thing. And that's wrong. Because economy, if you look back to the dictionary, you know, a simple one, at least in the Spanish dictionary, I can see that economy is related to what the human being is doing. And if that's the case, then the question will be, okay, what are the priorities for the human being? And in order to accomplish that priorities, we need to make sure that what we do at the economic level should be consistent with what we want to achieve. But it's not the case. And there's a reason for that. It's not happening just because I just say that. It's happened because if you look at the system, the heart of the system lies in competition. So what we are talking here is to change the paradigm, as simple as that. Of course, it's simple to say, but it's very complex to achieve it. If you look at, for example, on the planet or the environmental perspective, the whole discussion on changing all what we're doing because of the oil, or the gas, and moving to a more sustainable and environmental and green, for example, cars, we will realize that that technology already exists, but it's not in place. Why not? Well, we all know why not. We don't have to say it. So the point is not that there's no technology, that there's no political means to probably understand the situation. The problem is that those who control the economy in the planet, that I'm completely sure are in my just right hand, they don't want it to do so. But Donna just has said the right answer, in my personal view, which is we need to move a society based on cooperation instead of competition. There's no other way around. And in order to do so, we need to put into the perspective, for example, the whole discussion that we have on youth employment. Of course the youth don't have employment. And what they don't have it? Because the logic of the economy does not go in the direction to provide employment for youth. Because if you look at the basis or the pillars of the new economy lies in technology and financial money. You know, who's not here? It's in Wall Street, probably. And Wall Street is completely out of this house, and it's out of this discussion. So what would be the role of our countries? Well, at least have a discussion with those who have, you know, the means. Or create a mass, a critical mass, to change the equation. As simple as that. Why? Well, you may say, oh, okay, but we can live in the 21st century without technology and without financial capital or financial flows. Well, let me tell you something. We survived. How many years do we have the planet already? I don't know, 900 million years, or I don't know how many. But we survive. I mean, if you look at the historical perspective, the human beings have been here for not so much. It's not a problem of economy on financial things. It's a matter of who controls the resources of the planet and why and for what reasons. That's the question that we need to ask and to make coherence what we're saying here, what we want to achieve. And this is relevant also. Youth employment, again. Why youth don't get employment? Because they are being in an educational system in the whole planet doing things that are not, you know, relevant for the current system. I'm going to speak on behalf of El Salvador, of course, but I'm sure this example is across the planet. I'm very critical one of the educational system of my country. Why? Well, because if you go to any school in my country, either private or public school, they're still teaching or using or lying too much on memory. You know, so when Cristobal Colón or Christopher Columbus discovered America, everybody has to read and memorize the dates. Or who was, I don't know, any prophet of our country. So in what day somebody, you know, Jefferson or in our case, Martí, do something. We have to memorize many things. But we just forgot and missing the point of education. Education should be, you know, providing tools for students or for kids, you know, to have their own criteria. We need to teach them to think. That's simple. Why? You know, well, then kids will have the opportunity and the criteria to decide to do the good or the bad. It's a free will. It's their decision. But they need to think. If you ask me something that I do not know, I just open this thing and Google it, and I will tell you the answer. And that's it. But if you tell me why we are living or why youth doesn't have employment today, I will tell you, well, if I just look at the facts based on my criteria, I'll tell you why. And I'll tell you why also women is not treated equally in every place. But again, the answer would be, okay, so the international community needs to invade these countries and tell them, the government, listen, guys, you have to protect your women. That's the wrong approach again. I mean, does that make sense to you? No, What we need to do is empower persons, either men or women. They will freely decide based on their culture, their values, their own thinking, their criteria to decide what would be empowerment for them. It's not the same. Fortunately, I don't know how many millions are in the planet today, but thanks God we are not thinking the same. It would be very boring for all of us. You know, so having a different criteria, different ideas, provide us an opportunity to evolve. And that's what we're talking about right now. It's not a matter of a simple economic thing or trade. You know, we need to go back and save the planet. You know, all these stories on green economy is very funny, because it's just giving a different name to the same, you know, business as usual. We need to go back to the what is really making sense. You know, even my own government has the, you know, doing policies that are wrong. And I can freely tell you that. I know, because I'm not a politician. I'm trying to be someone who really want my country advance or progress with, you know, using common sense. El Salvador, 6 million people, 20,000 square kilometers. We used to have, you know, base our economy on agriculture. Not anymore. Like, let's say, like 20 or something, 15 years ago, our former president of our country decided that El Salvador no longer need to be an agricultural country, so we should move to a service country. So from one day, you know, the day after his decision, he thought that El Salvador will, you know, wake up and be in a service country, you know, having a hubs and many good things, airport, roads, things like that. Well, that's a very interesting approach. The problem is the, let's say, 3 million people who dedicated to agriculture the day before, you know, was ready or prepared to the day after, you know, just change their mind and start to be a service person or to serve as, you know, in hotels and all, provide all these things. I don't know. Reality proved that's very difficult to do so and continue to be a challenge for our country. Is this, you know, mean that we shouldn't move in that direction? Probably not. But what we didn't do, and as a learn or a learning experience for us, is, okay, at least let's have a dialogue among society and let's find out what the people think. But we didn't do that. And we didn't do that often in many countries of the planet, and even here at the UN, because we want to impose our views. And that's the problem again. I mean, someone has the power to do so. Someone can invite you and, you know, destroy the whole country in just one day. It's a very difficult thing. But what about the day after? That's the problem again. So now, coming back to youth education, gender issues, what our governments are doing, that's the problem. I mean, we need to take it personally. Because again, if you look back the history of the Americas and you go to the Jefferson and all these good men or the fathers, founder fathers of this country, what they say? Hey, this is a government should be part of the people. And we again are missing the point. You know, so it's not a matter of ideology. It's not a matter of if you're a communist or not. I mean, that's a very old-fashioned word. It's a matter of common sense. And if it's a matter of common sense, we need to start to think. And if we need to start to think, we need to teach our children to think. I'm not going to teach them what to think, but how. They will decide what they want. It's not my fault what they decide. But at least I want my children to have the opportunity to think and freely decide what they want. I think it's a very good opportunity for all of us to go in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. I'm just going to try to take the other questions really quickly, and then I'm going to try to take some more questions. On the question of balance, which I think either of the ladies can take, both Ms. Knox, because one question was on where do you start when you look at recommending policies? Do you start with agencies? Do you start with politicians? And the suggestion was also made on the question of balance that perhaps job sharing between youth and age might be a good way. I think balance is always going to be an issue for women, as long as you have women and as long as you have children. It's always going to be an issue of balance. But I do think it's an exciting challenge because we do have answers. Even the UN, we now have flexible working arrangements, which was, when I first came here, that was far off the radar. So I think we've come a long way. I'm going to have the ladies on both ends, Ms. Knox, and on the other end, Ms. Butts. Do you want to start on the balance, and then we'll go to the political question?
Great. Thank you. The thing about balance is that it's a constant process, and that I think that that's how we have to look at it as well, that as soon as things are in balance, we have to continue to always be juggling and looking at how we can increase the balance and increase the opportunity. There were a couple of things that I've thought of as you spoke, as Gail spoke, where to start. And I can only speak from our work here in the U.S., which is that our approach is to start with the policymakers. Our approach is to look at how we can insert intergenerational language wherever and whenever possible. A lot of people will say we need to have a big standalone bill in order to advance something, but where we've seen success is to be able to insert either opportunities for families, for intergenerational exchange, the role of older adults, the role of younger people, is to insert that language in policy so that people see it. A good example would be years ago when there was a policy created to provide mentors for young people of incarcerated parents. And we advocated for older adults being one of the types of mentors that were specifically mentioned in the policy. And we were told, of course, and it didn't end up there. Then we advocated that it be included in the authorizing language, and of course, and it didn't end up there. So I can guarantee you that there are very, very few programs that now engage older adults as those mentors because it wasn't in front of people. So we have to make sure that we're very intentional in how we insert and approach that policy. But I think the other thing that I would add is I'll not be brief. One is that what we've said here in the U.S. is that the common enemy of young and old is the economy, because you have young and you have older people who are both very, very concerned about their economic futures. And for younger, they may be looking at more years, but older and younger share that concern. They also share the desire to enter or exit the workforce as they want to. And many older adults fear being forced to retire before they're ready or not being able to retire because they don't have the resources. And so we need to look at that flexibility at times, not just when a family begins, but when somebody enters the workforce and as somebody's trying to exit the workforce. So it's really that lifelong approach. The other thing that we advocate very strongly is that we need to think in this country of the role of elders in a very different way. It's not a time to check out, it's a time to check in. It's a time to engage. It's a time to use that wisdom and to benefit our country from that wisdom. And I think a fabulous example are the elders that Desmond Tutu, Jimmy Carter, a number of people came together and formed, because they formed the elders to deal with things that other people didn't have the time or the courage or the wisdom to do. And I think that we need to call on elders to play that role. In his book, Dr. Bill Thomas, What Are Old People For?, what he said is that they really are the ones that protect our culture and make sure that we carry on. Whether it was back in the old days of hunting and gathering and older adults took care of the children so the younger populations could go and work, but it's that what the role of older adults is. And we need to set that bar, and we need to set that as an opportunity, and elder as a word of respect, of grace, and of obligation to our culture. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have two interesting questions that have come to us from Cuba. They're looking at the webcast. And I just thought it was interesting to give you their questions before you answer. The first question is, what projects does the UN have in place to bring together families divided by armed conflict? And the second question is, how can civil society organizations contribute to promote actions to benefit families? So, Ye Cuba, thank you for those questions. Would you like to?
In terms of where to start in policy making, grassroots efforts are always starting in the community. To agree with Donna said, always putting the word intergenerational in front and making sure that people recognize that we're serving two populations with one pool of money, that it's most economical in order to do that. Even with two city agencies working to the benefit of both populations, it's always difficult in order to make them realize that policy needs to be put in place in order for the work to continue in terms of intergenerational programming and shared communities. So it's very, very difficult to just say where, because as a city agency, we're always addressing our city council and our politicians as to where, why the money would be best spent on intergenerational programming. We're always having to explain to them, which some individuals get it. They don't need to, for you to have to draw the picture and color it in as well, because they have their own intergenerational experiences. Maybe they've been raised by grandparents, so they're the committed. They don't have to be convinced. It's just to get everyone else on board. And in terms of us being two city agencies working to collaborate for the benefit of both, I can only encourage grassroots efforts.
Thank you so much. Last round of questions. Chuck, you wanted question, comment?
Chuck Hitchcock from Peace Action. I'd like to add a social change component to this, and that is the newly emerging lesbian, gay, and transgendered families, and the problems that they encounter. I have an elderly friend in her 90s who, when she moved into an aging community, had to go back in the closet because she had no support from 400 or 500 other people living in this community.
Thank you, Chuck. The lady at the back, she's had her hand up for a long time. Yep. No, she's behind you. I'm going to come to you in a minute. Just wait on the mic. Put your hand up just so they can see. Right.
Good, thank you. I'm Dr. Yael Danieli. I represent the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. I want to pick up on one other disconnect that's absent from these discussions and to connect to the Cuban first question. There's a whole body of scientifically established knowledge about the multi-generational legacies of trauma. Trauma being war, being genocide, being crime, being domestic violence, on and on and on and on. This seems to not have any attention in these discussions. Neither last week, you know, the related panel, nor here today. And I find myself totally disconnected from it when I'm listening. Because, of course, we have actual data to show that traumatic history bears on work, the ability to work, the ability to raise your children correctly, the ability to provide for your children, the ability for families to speak from generation to generation, and between one set of families to another set of families. It is my expertise. I could speak for weeks on this, no end. But I just wanted to make a relationship.
Absolutely.
It's a huge body of scientifically established knowledge. It's not just beliefs. And it affects millions and millions of people around the world. And it affects economies. It affects everything you're talking about. The same way you talk about environmental issues affecting economies and affecting wars, well, wars affect the environmental issues, etc. Where is all of that in the UN deliberation and, and frankly, in the US deliberations? Not only do we have the highest rate of suicide among veterans, for example, today, that has a huge dangerous effect on even futures of families, but we have the children, the families show the results, we have results, on and on and on. I don't want to take too much time.
That's okay, but I got the drift.
I want the point to be part of this too.
Certainly. And thank you for bringing it to our attention.
I can definitely bring you the body of knowledge anytime you're interested.
Sure. Thanks a lot. In front.
I'm Helen Hamlin. I represent the International Federation on Aging and have been here for about 20 years. And I would just like to I have two comments. One is to tell the ambassador that he's like a breath of fresh air. I have listened to many, many diplomats and other dignitaries, and none have been as inclusive and as welcoming as you have. So I thank you for that on behalf of us older people. I would like to ask whether it's going to be possible in the post-2015 agenda discussions, which are going on now, to make sure that older persons and older persons' issues are included. We are not in the MDGs, and when Agenda 21 came out 20-odd years ago, we were not included in that. And we are very multi-generational in the older community. And so it's important for what's been happening here today and the kind of cooperation we've heard about today be further incorporated. I attended a session last week, another symposium on intergenerational solidarity, and there was not one word about older people. And I was really outraged and had an opportunity to express myself to two of the panelists, both of whom, one of whom acknowledged that, yes, she had forgotten to talk about older people. Well, you can't talk about future generations without including and thinking about the other generations. And I'm a member of that committee that Elizabeth mentioned on the intergenerational relations thing. We are very intergenerationally minded and welcome the society for all ages, as the Madrid Second World Assembly noted. We are looking for equality and involvement of all generations. And I think I'll stop at that.
Thank you so much. I'm just going to take the two last ones, one from the gentleman in the back and one from Judy.
Good morning. My name is Jim Collins. I'm with the International Council on Social Welfare, and I'm chair of the NGO Committee on Aging here in New York. I want to thank you, Ms. Bentley Taylor, for bringing this panel together. It's been very, very useful and informative for our work. I want to follow up on one of the concepts that the Ambassador Garcia Gonzalez made about it being the time for us all to come together and work together. While it's true that each of our groups have our own interests and we do have to advocate for them, it's also equally true that it's now time for us to work together. I think, for example, it's very important for older groups to be advocating for efforts to reduce youth unemployment. I think it's very, one of the most important ideas I've heard in the UN is that the best anti-poverty measure is to educate women. And I think we in older groups need to be supporting these efforts. On the other hand, we in the aging community really need the support of other groups as we advocate here for a convention on the rights of older persons. And I would certainly invite all of you who aren't in aging to come to the next session of the open-ended work group on aging and say, younger people need this. We one day will be old. We will need dignity and respect in our old age. And so I really encourage other people to support us in this effort. I think it's also very important that all groups work together and say, UN, you passed this social protection floor initiative a couple of years ago. Well, what are you doing about it? I think we need to go back and keep that on everybody's radar. Also, as Helen just mentioned, the post-2015 development agenda, that has to be universal in the sense that it has to apply for every person on the globe. I attended another forum last week when they were talking about the human rights indicators, and a representative of Mexico pointed out, and when we start looking at either outcome indicators or process indicators, whenever we come up with goals and we have these indicators, it's important that this data on these goals be indicators be disaggregated, whether it's on gender, age, ethnicity. We have to insist upon this, and I think we in civil society have to unite around this as the member states negotiate the post-2015 agenda. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we are at the end of our program, so I'm trying to make sure that we get at least one more question in. You look very comfortable, so I'm going to make sure that we finish on a high note. So, Judy, would you ask your question?
Is it on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm Judy Lerner, Peace Action International. I've been struggling here for the first time in my life to think of how to frame a question for this. And I thought of one. If we could try to get people to tell their story, it seems to me that that's something that we can get where we will have solidarity. But I want to tell my story quickly because I think Gail Bendley Taylor is responsible for what happened to me when I came to the United Nations. At the disarmament meeting in Mexico, it was Gail's idea to find the oldest NGO and the youngest NGO in Mexico and put them together to have a Twitter to say why we wanted peace. I said, a Twitter? What the hell is that? And anyway, I was only 88 at the time. And it was an extraordinary experience. And Ban Ki-moon was there. The young man, the 19-year-old, said, don't worry, Judy. I'll do the Twitter. You do the talking. We have worked here at the United Nations. I've been chair of the International Intergenerational Committee for two of the conferences. I work with the young people. It is an extraordinary personal experience to work with young people at the UN, and I encourage everyone to do that. And I think that all these other issues can be resolved when we find young people respecting what you do and you respect what they do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judy. I'm going to wrap up now. Chuck, do you have any announcements just before everybody?
I too would like to thank you and everyone on the panel. It's been an extraordinary morning, and thank you very much. The only announcement I have is save the date for the annual DPI NGO Executive Committee fundraiser, which will be at Merkin Hall on June 30th. It will include two youth choirs from the United States, plus at least one singing ambassador. Maybe she'll bring others. And it benefits the NGO DPI Executive Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to ask each of our panelists to take whichever question they would like to respond to. And at the same time, as you leave us, to leave us with any final thoughts you have on the subject. One, I would like somebody to look at the question raised by Chuck about lesbian, gay, and transgender families and how we address those. The other thing that has come up, which I think came up as well from Cuba, which is the issue of trauma, aspects of trauma, as it affects intergenerational solidarity. The question from
Cuba was what projects does the UN have to bring together divided families by families divided by armed conflict? And the other question of how can civil society organizations contribute to promote actions to benefit families? The comments on the fact that, you know, in the intergenerational issue is not in the MDGs, but we should also look at the question of older groups supporting the question of youth employment, for example, in order that you have reciprocity there across generations as well, that you can have young people supporting the older person's push for a convention as well. The other question about where does US-UN deliberations, for example, where does the issue of trauma come into either US or UN deliberations? I'm leaving these up to all of whichever one of you wants to take them, and I'll start with Ambassador. You want to start first?
Thank you very much. I'll try to be brief. In fact, all the questions that you just have raised, including our friend from Cuba, I will answer in two ideas. The first, and both of them has already been said, so for me it's just a kind of wrap-up. The first idea is the following, disconnection. That's the problem, because everything that has been said in this question is already taken care by different UN bodies. For example, the issue of trauma in terms of the importance of mental health across the UN agenda is already there. We have a very interesting resolution in the plenary of the General Assembly which relates health issues and foreign relations or foreign policy. It was promoted by Brazil and supported by many countries, including El Salvador, that has the basis for a very broad discussion on the connection of those issues. Second, trauma, again, in a question from Cuba, in the post-conflict countries, we have the Peace-Building Commission. The Peace-Building Commission is the very interesting issue or body within the UN that is fed by three charter bodies, the Security Council, General Assembly, and ECOSOC. The problem is that nobody is connecting, again, discussion within the Peace-Building Commission that has 4 to 5 or 6 now specific countries in their agenda with the rest of the agenda of the UN. So it's not a problem of that we have or not address that specific project or discussion. We already have it, but we are not connecting, again, that discussion. The issue on the post-2015 agenda, of course, that's fundamental. That's why, I mean, in the case of the Commission for Social Development and the Commission on the Status of Women, we started to have within this year sessions, as a priority theme and as an emerging issue, the relationship between empowerment of people in relation to the post-2015 agenda. The same happened, but in a, let's say, less, not so openly discussion on the context of the Commission on Population and Development, because migration, which is, of course, a fundamental issue as well, has to be related to the agenda post-2015. And again, with the issue of disconnection, I would like to bring to your attention the following. It's not only the post-2015 agenda. It's important, it's fundamental, we need to take a look at that. But it's also another area that is a little higher, which is what happened with the discussion on the context of different executive boards of UNDP, UNFPA, UNOPS, UNICEF, World Food Program. Do you know? These guys have the money. And we, I mean, collectively speaking, we're not paying attention to that discussion. You know, I mean, and I can say it publicly because El Salvador already have a position in this matter. We are in a process of discussion of some certain reforms in the context of the executive board of UNFPA for different pressures because donors, I mean, I'm not saying any specific one, donors in general, wanted to reduce and take out all these agencies from Latin America, for example. And they say, okay, we don't have money anymore for Latin America, we're going to focus on Africa. But guess what? Not in the whole continent of Africa, just in certain countries in Africa. And what they are doing so, why they are doing so well? Because the money is not anymore for development. And what's the change? Well, in the context of the mandate for this executive board or funds agency of program of the UN, they are simply changing the mandate and focusing their attention, in the case of UNFPA, on health issues. So El Salvador said, okay, so now that the UNFPA, which is supposed to be the agency with the mandate to go in these intergenerational issues, having a mandate to address the issues or the demographic trends in the elderly, we are now just moving back to women and girls again and only health issues. So we are changing. We already have the World Health Organization in Geneva now being replaced by UNFPA in New York. So what's that? And it's already happening. The negotiations are there. We are opposing that thing, and that's why I can say it publicly. But again, there are certain issues that are not, you know, in our radar, and we need to connect them because everything is related. That is affecting also cooperation or international cooperation. You know, you hear a lot of South cooperation. Why? Because it's a very good way to, you know, move away from the North-South cooperation. Come on. It's not about money. It's about how we see the world. And that's the importance of everything. You mentioned a very important group as well. In our country, I can tell you, from this administration, 2009, to the office, we came from a very conservative society, I can say that. But this administration do something very interesting. They decide to change and shift the paradigm. We move from a welfare conception towards a more human right-based approach. In doing so, that simple, let's say, change on policy, we made a great progress. The first thing that we do was to remove the reservation that El Salvador has to Cairo. And in going in that direction, we were able to join the whole program of Cairo and start, you know, having considering the issue of lesbian, gays, and all of this vulnerable group as well. We have in the office of our First Lady and the Minister of Social Integration, she has an office that deals with these issues for the first time in our whole history. I mean, I'm not saying that we're perfect, but what I'm saying is that we're trying to do things differently. Maybe it takes time, but it's a working process. And finally, this is important. I know that we have different views, interests, you know, perception or whatever, and as John said, this is the time for unity. Really, it's time for unity. We need to integrate. We need to cooperate. We need to partner. If we are not going to do so, then we will not be able to create the critical mass to do the change. So my positive message would be, okay, let's you know, roll our leaves, start to work. There's no time to waste. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. Ms. Butts?
Thank you. In the interest of time, I'll try to be brief about and just make a couple of comments. One is that I think that there were some very important points that were made by you folks. One of the things that we work with at Generations United, one of our reasons for working with grand families is because those are generally families that have faced trauma. That's such a big part of why we need to support and encourage the family and help them with healing. And we're seeing more and more families where the grandparents are critical because of extended deployment, because of the condition that our military members are coming home. Many people don't realize this, but the first young woman who was killed in Iraq was a single mother, and so her parents are raising her daughter. So it is something that permeates the field. I wanted to make two other quick points, which are that Judy, you're a wonderful, wonderful example of how the power of connecting between generations and across generations. We know that young people have the organization and technological skills to be able to really fuel a movement, and that older adults have the wisdom and the experience to help guide that. So together, it's an incredible combination. I think it's that mutual respect and realizing that people at every age have something incredible to offer. And then lastly, it's always easy to look at what there isn't. So I wanted to point out something that there is that I point out a lot, and that is in the years that I've been engaged with the UN, I have been very impressed with the inclusion of intergenerational language and an inclusion of intergenerational solidarity. I think it was expected somewhat in the aging focal point, and very great to see the intergenerational language that's included there. It was less expected in the youth focal point and the family focal point, and to see the preparation going forward for the International Year of the Family to include intergenerational solidarity and acknowledge all generations of a family, I think is wonderful. So I would just like to thank and say kudos to you folks for that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Elizabeth, Nylon?
Yeah, this will probably be pretty quick. This is to our friends in Cuba. Unfortunately, I can't actually answer that question in terms of giving you examples of concrete projects, but I will certainly be able to get back to you once I go back to my office with people who have been there a bit longer and have an intergenerational dialogue about things that happened before I got there. So again, a nice learning experience, but we can certainly get back to them on Twitter once we get their details. Yeah, I mean, Donna and the ambassador have kind of touched really on everything. I don't really need to add all that much, but I mean, I just for your friend who's going through that experience, nobody should have to do that. You should never have to go through something like that. We all deserve our human rights to be respected at the most basic of levels, and you know, being yourself is really what's that about? What last inspiring words do I have? I think, like I said, we're talking about so many different levels of dialogue and intergenerational solidarity and social integration. And for me, it really, what we can do is at a small step, is take all these small steps ourselves. And what can we do when we get home, whether it be with our kids or grandkids, whether it be in the community, whether it be deciding to, you know, something more concrete like joining some type of an intergenerational volunteer activity or so forth, it doesn't take much to kind of get involved in something and start changing our own mindset. Because as much as younger people sometimes have a tendency to kind of disregard older generations, we often hear older generations talking about those pesky kids and what are they up to now and everything. We have this kind of social stigma against these two sides, but you know, the reality is we all start out young, and hopefully with any luck, we all end up checking out of here at a ripe old age. So, just trying to keep that in mind that, yeah, we're all on this kind of journey together.
Thanks. Thank you so much. And last but not least, Teresa Knox.
Thank you. In terms of your any older adult having to deny the person that they are during their twilight years, it's, you know, extremely disrespectful, and the only answer to that is to continue to educate and to teach tolerance in terms of all human rights. And in terms of the progress that the UN has made in terms of keeping intergenerational dialogue continuing and always appearing in the forefront, our work continues, and we still have much to do. So
thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, panelists. You are an exciting panel, full of ideas. I hope that for the NGOs, however, that you've taken away there's been a lot of information given, and I hope you'll be able to take a lot of what has been given on both intergenerational solidarity and the question of social integration. Thank you for being here. Please check your calendars regarding the next briefing, because right now we're not dead certain of the date or the room, because we've had problems with both. But it's possible that there may be another one toward the end of May, and so we ask you to please check your calendars. Happy International Day of the Families, and enjoy the rest of the day with your family.